from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point when big-time investor, economist Mohammed El-Aryan gets up at 3 a.m. to read the day's news. He sees a world in a whole lot of flux. Washington, New York, Europe, unable to steer economies or global events like they once did. The global economy poised to finally really take off, but maybe one more crazy headline away from global recession. He puts the odds at 50-50. Either way, he's planning for both, and he advises you and me and our leaders to do the same. This hour on Point, a conversation with super investor economist Mohammed El-Aryan. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see out there in the headlines, at work, in your bank statements? Do you see a connection between your job, your nest egg, and what goes on in Washington, Ukraine, Gaza, Iraq? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Special welcome today to our new listeners on 1019 Detroit's public radio station. We are delighted to have you with us. Joining me now from Tustin, California, is Mohammed El-Aryan, former CEO and co-CIO with Bill Gross of the giant investment management firm PIMCO, advisor to the giant German insurance firm Allianz, chair of President Obama's Global Development Council, a columnist for Bloomberg, contributing editor at the Financial Times. Mohammed El-Aryan is author of the best-selling When Markets Collide and a forthcoming book on central banks and the economy. Foreign Policy listed him as one of the top 100 global thinkers for 4 years in a row. Son of an Egyptian diplomat, former deputy director at the IMF, former managing director at Citigroup in London. Mohammed El-Aryan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. You're chair of President Obama's Global Development Council. Does that mean you speak for or channel the thinking of the president?
Absolutely not. The council is a group of people from very diverse backgrounds and experiences and education. And our job is to provide input to the administration on global development issues, but in no way do we reflect the thinking of the administration.
You say that you see a fork in the road in front of us, that the road we're on is ending and there will be movement this way or that. What's the road we're on? What's the fork look like, sir?
So we're on a road full of contradictions. You know, every day you pick up the newspaper and there's yet another contradiction. How is it that we've had the biggest stimulus program from the Federal Reserve, a ton of money put into this, into the economy, and yet the economy hasn't achieved liftoff? How is it that we have cautious companies unwilling to use their cash for anything more than defensive mergers and acquisitions, and yet we have investors willing to take enormous risk? How is it that we have equity prices near all-time high, and yet interest rates, which are supposed to be correlated the other way, also doing what they're doing? So we're full of contra- and the reason why is we are on this artificial road where we are buying time for one thing to happen, which is for the economy to heal. And unfortunately, the economy is not healing fast enough. So either we're going to hand off to what we all wish, which is liftoff, escape velocity for the economy that creates jobs and financial stability, or unfortunately, we will go back into financial instability. And Tom, the most frustrating thing right now for anybody who looks at this is that the probabilities are basically equal. And that is very frustrating because we're not used to having two outcomes that are so extreme with similar probabilities.
Is 50-50, is saying that the probabilities are 50-50, is that a cop-out, Mohammed El-Aryan? I mean, describe the cases that can be made for liftoff, the case that can be made for down the tubes, so that we can judge how you end up calling them a 50-50 in likelihood.
So it sounds like a cop-up, and there's nothing more that I'd like than to say this is what's likely to happen. Mm. But you've got to be honest. And when there's this amount of uncertainty, when there is this amount of new things happening, you've got to recognize that it's hard to predict with a lot of conviction and foundation. You know, you have to have foundation to have conviction, and it's simply hard. Now, what makes it a good outcome? A few things. One is undoubtedly the U.S. economy is healing. We've come a very long way. You see this in the labor market. You see this in the health of the corporate sector. So we've come a long way. And at some point, the healing reaches critical mass. We also have wonderful innovations going on that are empowering people to be more productive. We have an energy revolution going on. And we have a set of countries in the world that are becoming not just good producers, but good consumers. You put all that together, and that is what brings the liftoff. And if our politicians in Washington were to step up to their responsibility in terms of economic governance, we get there very quickly. On the other hand, we have a Europe that is struggling. And remember, Europe as a whole is the biggest economic region. Mm-hmm. We have China that's trying to manage something that very few countries have achieved. It's called the middle-income transition. When you go from being a teenager, if you like, to being an economic adult, and that's very hard to do in a country as complex as China. And then we have a set of geopolitical risks that have a common theme, which is the lack of global leadership. And finally, for now 4 or 5 years, we've been very deep in economic experimentation at the Federal Reserve. And no one knows the balance of what former Chairman Bernanke called, quote, the benefit, costs, and risks. At some point, as he acknowledged, as Chair Yellen acknowledges, the costs and risks become larger than the benefits. So if you look at both these issues, very complex, very unusual, and unfortunately, broadly similar probabilities. Now, the critical thing to do, Tom, is not to get paralyzed. The critical thing is to understand how we navigate these distributions that instead of having one likely outcome, have two potential outcomes. And it's a very different way of thinking.
Help us look a little bit at the geopolitics out there right now. There's been so much hopping and popping. I mean, there's little Libya with all of its issues. There's China and the tensions in the South China and East China Sea. And then there's all the hot stuff, Gaza and Syria and ISIS and Iraq and Ukraine. Do those matter in economic terms? Do we have a strong enough economy that those things can just, frazzle along and it's not a problem? Or do they matter?
So they do matter, and they matter for the following reasons. One is there's a common theme to them. And the common theme has two elements. One is the role of non-state actors. And secondly is the inability of some external force, be it a G1 like the United States or a G7 or a G20.
You're talking about the old Group of 20, the Group of 7, the G1, kind of a humorous term, but when the United States was the big superpower.
Correct. And the importance here is to have an external power that can inform, influence outcomes, and some cases even impose outcomes. And there's good reasons for that, which have to do with the difficulty of two parties negotiating if they don't trust each other and if they can't verify compliance with what each commits to. So we have what Ian Bremmer has called the G0 world. The core has weakened, and the core is the Western economies, and they are still going through a major recovery process. So that's the first element. There's something in common there.
But G0, meaning group nobody in charge, isn't capitalism hypothetically supposed to deal with that just fine? You don't necessarily have to have someone in charge. It's supposed to be kind of its adherence and promoters say a rational system. All on markets will be rational, and therefore you don't need a whip hand above it.
So that would be correct if, first of all, people were acting rationally, and sometimes they don't for good reasons. And secondly, and importantly, if you didn't get market failures. And right now we have not just market failures, we have coordination failures, we have cooperation failures, we have information asymmetry. So even those who buy capitalism totally will tell you once in a while we do get market failures, and put on top of that human behavior, and the behavioralists have really advanced our understanding of that. And at that point, you need some sort of conductor. Let me put it a different way. If you have an orchestra full of really good musicians, and each is playing a tune, but you don't have a conductor, then the outcome may not be as good as if you had a conductor. And what capitalism needs is a conductor. And I can tell you, having been in the financial sector, I tell you that when the conductor fails, which is the regulators, then you get the mess that we got in 2008 because people take too much risk. So capitalism works great as long as we counter the tendencies for market failure.
So who was the conductor? Who's no longer on stage? Who was there making things work smoothly?
So it was the core of the system that constituted first the West, secondly the multilateral institutions like the IMF and the World Bank, and then the periphery used to be smaller and used to abide by certain rules of the game. Today is different. The core is weak. The West is still recovering from its crisis. The multilateral institutions have lost a lot of credibility and legitimacy because they don't represent the world of today. They represent the world of yesterday. And the periphery has gotten much bigger. And now the periphery is starting to build pipes that bypass the system. Look at what the BRICS, this is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, just last month they got together and they decided to create a new development bank. They decided to create a currency sharing arrangement. And basically what they're saying is, even though we have the World Bank out there, even though we have the IMF right there, we're going to create our own institution.
Is that so bad? Your analysis can sound kind of West-centric. It is sort of like a nostalgia for the age of Western imperialism.
It could, but what I'm basically saying is that the system has to reform. The system has to catch up to the reality of today. And if it doesn't, then various actors, be they state actors or non-state actors, will try and create alternative pipes. And they'll try to bypass the system. And that will cause a lot of potholes on the road. And that is what we're seeing today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with super investor, economist, big global thinker Mohammed El-Aryan about the state of the global economy and ours, America's, at a time of great global uncertainty in many regions right now, even upheaval. He joins us from California today, former CEO at the huge investment management firm PIMCO, chair of President Obama's Global Development Council, a big voice out there for a long time, born to an Egyptian diplomat, lived all over the world, and a long time in the United States now. Mohammed El-Aryan, we've got lots of people responding online here saying, look, we don't want and we don't think we can sustain the economy as we've known it. Maybe we need some kind of fork in the road, that we can't go on with resource-intensive, perpetual inputs of finite resources here, people writing to us. Maybe it's time for a new way. What do you say to that?
So I think they have a point. I think that the good thing about folks in the road is that they encourage new thinking. They bring out trade-offs, and it's about time that we start talking about trade-offs. The bad news is, in order to navigate well a fork, you need a certain amount of planning. You need a map that explains when the fork is coming and where the alternative roads lead to. And that is what we're lacking right now. We have a political system that is so polarized that it cannot even agree on things that everybody knows is in the common interest. I'll give you a list. We know that we have a labor market that isn't functioning well, with an unemployment rate of 20% among teenagers.
You're talking in the USA here, okay.
In the USA, and 3.2 million long-term unemployed, and yet there's been very little to improve the functioning. We know that our infrastructure needs upgrading and interest rates are very low. So it makes a lot of sense to borrow and invest in productive infrastructure, and yet we're not doing this. Immigration, there's an agreement that we need reform, both political parties, and yet there is no action. And finally, the tax system, which encourages companies to do things that are not in the national interest. So there's lots of areas where there already is common understanding and common agreement, and yet our political system can't come up with solutions. Now, if that's the case for what is known, what about the known unknowns, and what about the unknown unknowns? So, yes, forks, T-junctions are a good thing because they force you to think about trade-offs, but unfortunately our political system is not up to the task right now.
The Federal Reserve Bank, in the absence of action from, I guess you're saying, Congress right there, has taken the lead. How's that gone? How's that going? Can they still steer the economic ship to success?
So the Federal Reserve is the one institution that has political autonomy, meaning that it can take action without approval from Congress. And it has. For both moral and ethical obligation, it has felt compelled to act as the main policymaker. That's a good thing, even though, and that's a bad thing, it doesn't have the correct instruments. So what I just mentioned, immigration, labor markets, infrastructure, tax systems, all that thing that the Federal Reserve can do. So the Federal Reserve is using second and third best policies to buy time for the system to heal and to buy time for the political process to be able to step up to its responsibility. If you believe that that's going to happen, if you believe that we're going to have an economic handoff and the political system is going to step up to its responsibility, then the Fed will look like a hero. If, however, these handoffs fail, then we're going to be dealing with the collateral damage and the unintended consequences of experimental monetary policy, which, and what are those? Another financial crisis.
And by crisis, you mean recession, depression, something, downturn.
I mean unstable financial markets that make companies even more risk-averse, that make consumers worry about their wealth and their retirement, and therefore they spend less today. We produce less, we consume less, and we end up in a very low-growth equilibrium where for the first time in a very, very long time, the next generations of American may be worse off than the current. And that is the risk that we need to realize and we need to avert it. And we can avert it. That's the irony, Tom, is this is not an engineering problem. Mm. The engineering side is clear. It is a political problem.
I mean, you say we can avert it, but that's not so clear to me. What does that mean? One side has to win hands down in Washington and then take that way? We certainly don't seem to have any capacity to compromise lately.
We don't, because each side is much more worried about its fringe than it is about coming together in the middle. So if you are a politician worried about re-election, you're more likely to worry about who is more extreme than you. If you're a Republican, you worry more about the Tea Party than you worry about your Democratic opponent. And similarly on the other side. So therefore, what happens is what makes you win the primaries is not what makes you govern well. And somehow we need to fix that. And we need to fix that by people stepping up to their responsibility once they win their elections and realizing that there's a lot of common ground on many of these issues.
Federal Reserve's number two official, Stanley Fischer, saying just yesterday in Stockholm that global growth has been disappointing, warning of fundamental headwinds here that pulling down future gains. He said, year after year, we have had to explain from mid-year why global growth rate has been lower than predicted as little as two quarters back. He said the slowing is broad-based, with performance emerging in emerging Asia. Importantly, China stepping down sharply from the post-crisis surge. Even China. Mohammed Alarian is with us, big investor, big economist, big voice in the world of the global economy. Joins us from California. Lots of callers for you. Cody in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Cody, you're on with Mohammed Alarian.
Thanks, Tom. I disagree with your guess that this need one side winning. One side is winning. It's the people looking for short-term profit. They run our government. We have two parties, the capitalist left party and the capitalist right party. It's all just a smokescreen to dig up every last resource in the next 20, 30 years, and the 1% makes a profit off it. They throw us a few bones, and it's pretty optimistic that we can keep a growth economy going. We need a steady state economy, something that's sustainable. This capitalism is not sustainable as we know it. Thank you.
Cody, I appreciate your call. Others along this line, Mohammed, here on Facebook, Joe says the U.S. is screwed unless you're filthy rich. Middle class will become the poor class. The poor class will be pushed to the gutters. Cody says we need a steady state economy. I mean, people are looking for the exits on this system in this circumstance, Mohammed.
So Cody and others raised two very important issues. The current world today encourages two types of outcomes. One is tactical versus strategic. So people think very short term. They're not willing to make long-term commitments. That is why companies have massive cash balances and yet are not investing. And secondly, it also is a world that encourages more income and wealth inequality. And it's just not just income and wealth inequality. It is the trio. It's also inequality of opportunity. So they are right to be worried. Ironically, let's go back to the Fed. The Fed itself acknowledged that because it's using imperfect instruments, it has no choice but to come through the financial markets in order to promote consumption and investment. How does it do it? By artificially raising asset prices in order to trigger what the economists call the wealth effect. You feel richer.
Asset prices as in stock market prices.
Correct.
Stock prices.
Mm-hmm. So we open our 401k, we feel richer, and then we go spend more. Or you trigger what's called animal spirits. that somehow people are willing to invest more. Now, who owns financial assets?
People with money.
Yeah, it's too rich. So we are in a world in which all these short-term solutions encourage short-term behavior and also aggravate income and wealth inequality and therefore aggravate the inequality of opportunity. The Fed recognizes that and it says, you know what? That's true, but it's in the short term. If we get economic handoff, then everybody is better off. But there's no doubt that Cody and others are right. In the short term, we are in a very tactical as opposed to strategic world where the people with financial assets do better. And that is a concern.
And you hear people like Cody sort of checking out on the system, looking for something different, looking for something better. I mean, you're saying Congress, get off your haunches and do something so the Fed doesn't have to do this very roundabout treatment of things. Cody's saying, forget it. I want something else. Dan in Austin, Texas. Dan, you're on the air.
Well, my comment this morning was that being in Austin, we are in a very fine economy here.
Good for you.
We're growing. Unemployment is very low, and we're doing extremely well. We're actually struggling with the consequences of growth and traffic and housing.
Yep.
But what it seems, I'm a business lawyer in Austin, represent large and small businesses, and I see success. What I see in the statistics, and we all know about statistics and what they can do.
Yes.
But it appears that the GDP is growing nicely in the country, and there's been good, healthy growth in the GDP. And what we're struggling with as a country, and I'm sure this is worldwide, is how that gain is distributed.
Yeah.
We are struggling with distribution of that wealth.
Dan, are you confident that if the economy really takes off again, that distribution will happen automatically?
Well, you know, I was born in the 50s, and I remember. I think I was taught, and I thought I heard Eisenhower teach us that when a government focuses on the well-being of the middle class, it is always doing the right thing. The rich have a way of taking care of themselves.
Yep.
We have a middle class because we work at it and we make an effort to take care of it. I think that we are really struggling with conditions in the middle class in the United States. And I think the irony is that when they do well, when they are provided for, when there is job opportunity, the whole economy does well, and the rich do extremely well.
Dan, I appreciate your call from Austin and your observations there. Mohammed, how do we get that middle class and those in poverty beneath it with better seats at the table here? Do you see it in the offing? Even if the economy comes back, a lot of people have said we have a structural problem. Those jobs aren't going to be there. The wages just don't move the money around to everybody in the way they once did. How do we get back to that? Or do we need a new way to it?
Tom, Dan is right. First, let me acknowledge that Texas is one of the bright spots in the country, apart from football, but it's one of the bright spots when it comes to economic activity. And energy and oil has a lot to do with that. And high oil prices has a lot to do with that. But Texas is definitely one of the bright spots. On his second comment of the hollowing out of the middle class and how detrimental that is to not just the economy, but to social stability. He's absolutely right. We've had a hollowing out of the middle class that is continuing. And it links to his point on GDP, but I differ a little bit from him. GDP hasn't been doing well. Economists all agree on two things. One is GDP growth has been below potential. Put another way, the speed limit may be 55 miles an hour. We have a car capable of driving safely at 55 miles an hour, but we're driving at 25 miles an hour. And the second element, which is equally worrisome, is that the capacity of the economy to grow is coming down. So the speed limit in future will no longer be 55 miles, it'll be 40 miles per hour, even though the vehicle can be driven safely at that. Because of that, we don't create enough jobs. Because of that, wages are stagnant. Because of that, the middle class suffers, and we end up increasingly hollowing out the middle class. So growth and inclusive growth becomes a critical element. And as you quoted Stanley Fischer's speech from yesterday in Sweden, one of the Federal Reserve governor, it is really frustrating that year after year after year, we have had to revise down our predictions. We have been disappointed with outcomes because we haven't quite understood that this is a different economy. And it's an economy that requires some long-term thinking. And unfortunately, that hasn't occurred.
But Dan says, take care of the middle class. He said Eisenhower is focused on that, and of course, many others as well, and everything else will work out. But what would that mean? How do we come up with jobs that are going to pay well to create and support that middle class?
We do it in three ways. The first thing we do is we don't cause ourselves unnecessary injury. And we've done that as a society. We did this in the global financial crisis when excessive risk-taking by the private sector brought the economy to its knees and almost tipped it into a multi-year depression. We did that when Congress decided to shut down the government for 18 days and then decided to have a fight over the debt limit. So there's lots of things that we can avoid ourselves. We did that by having too much fiscal contraction at a time when our economy needed more demand. The second element, so for the first thing is do less harm. The second element is do more good. We need to work on the supply side, infrastructure that I mentioned earlier, immigration, the tax system. These are all things that are capable of being improved if there's political will. And then the third issue is that we need to recognize that certain segments of our society need particular help. We still have debt overhangs. We still have people that are crushed by excessive debt. And there is a need to focus on particular segments that need help. And the good news over the last few months, especially with the book from Thomas Piketty, the French economist, called Capital, that has triggered quite a discussion about income distribution, is that the rich realize increasingly that you cannot be a good house in a challenged neighborhood, that the interdependencies are such that it is in the interest of everybody to try and regain a path that promotes the middle class.
What's the evidence that that's been realized? What's the action that's been taken that would evidence that?
I wish I could tell you there's lots of action. I think the first element, Tom, is recognition. There's a lot more recognition today that this is a joint problem and a joint responsibility than there was a year ago, and certainly than there was 3-4 years ago. So there's a lot more recognition, and without recognition, you don't get to solutions. And I think that hopefully there will be more solutions. Now, the reason why I go back to the notion of a junction or fork or what the British call the T-junction is that it's not just a national issue, but it's also a global issue. And we need a conductor on the global stage, just like we need one on the national stage.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with super investor, economist, big global thinker Mohammed El-Arian about the state of the global economy and ours, America's, at a time of great global uncertainty, upheaval in many regions. He says that may well intersect with some tough economic times. A fork in the road is coming up, says Mohammed El-Arian. We could do very well. We're hearing skepticism in this hour about whether we have the resources to get on the old up path. We could do very poorly if geopolitics and a lack of coordination and planning and care leave us out in the cold. All kinds of response here. Lots of doubt and skepticism has been produced in these recent years, Mohammed, and I'm sure you hear that plenty as well. People want to be optimistic, but they look around and it's not easy. Brian in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on with Mohammed El-Arian.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to speak first on the false equivalence that you guessed made earlier. The idea that the Democratic Party is as beholden to, say, Occupy Wall Street as the Republicans are to the Tea Party is just ridiculous. But actually, I wanted to say that some of his solutions, you know, the sources of optimism that he mentioned earlier, are really worrying to me. The idea that we have to do is get developing nations to consume that we do, you know, the same way that we do in the West, is just a recipe for disaster. And you know, he mentioned innovation and worker productivity. Well, worker productivity has been going up, booming since the 70s, and workers have been seeing in the U.S. certainly and elsewhere have been seeing less and less share of that. And you know, he says that the solutions are political, but it sounds like these don't sound like political solutions to me. He says that the elite are recognizing new things, but it sounds to me that he hasn't recognized much at all. And these are, you know, sources of optimism, then I think our chances are much worse than 50-50.
Brian, I appreciate your call. Mohammed, Brian's not buying your sources of optimism there. They've got their own inherent issues.
So Brian raises a number of interesting issues. First, a questioning as to whether the developing world, which now has the wallet to spend, should also have the will to spend. Look at China. China is in the midst of a transition from a producer-pushed, export-pushed economy to one that relies more on local demand. If China succeeds in doing this, it will manage what's called the middle-income transition, and it will be able to provide to its citizens a higher standard of living.
But local demand means consumption, and Brian says if China and everybody else rev up to the kind of consumption we've seen in the U.S. and the rest of the first world, we've got a disaster on our hands.
Well, China is so much below where we are, right? But Brian is correct in saying that this has to be done thoughtfully. But it's very hard to tell the Chinese, who have been working very hard, that they cannot consume what they've earned. Now, there's a reason why they don't consume what they've earned is because they are worried about the education system. They're worried about the retirement system. So you get what's called excessive savings. It's hard to believe, but if you have excessive savings in an economy, everybody's worse off. I agree with Brian when he says that the recognition isn't leading to action. That is why there are two potential outcomes. That is why, despite an enormous amount of effort that the Fed has put in, despite healing in the United States, we still aren't anywhere near escape velocity. There needs to be more action. And the last point he raises, which is a fair point, which is which party is pulled more to the extreme, and I think most people would agree with him, it is the Republican Party, given the role of the Tea Party. Now, having said all this, he gives a higher probability to a bad outcome, and that is a judgment call. And you know, it's hard to say he's wrong. All I can say is we have the measures in order to tilt the probabilities in a better way. And if we don't, it's not just about this generation, but it's about the most underrepresented generations of all, which is the next generation.
Speak to the core issue, though, that Brian put on the table there, and many are asking about this. Ted writes online, he says, missing from this conversation is climate change, resource, water, food scarcity, how it affects the calculus. Brian's presumption that a big uptick in consumption globally won't be the old miracle elixir for humanity, but rather a path to real trouble, because all that consumption in a resource-pressed time could mean doom. What do you say to that?
I say, Tom, it speaks to the general point I raised earlier, which is we have a system right now, politically, economically, financially, that encourages people to focus on the short term, that encourages people to be very tactical as opposed to strategic. And that is a problem.
I don't hear an answer in that. With respect, consumption has always been seen as the way to glory economically. Here, is there another way that doesn't deplete what people increasingly see as finite global resources? You're supposed to be a great economist. How do we deal with that?
And that's why I come back to innovation. Let me give you a few examples. The farmer in the Midwest today, just like the farmer in Africa today, can be much more productive. He or she has access to tools that were unthinkable just 10 to 15 years ago. He or she has a better way of predicting weather patterns and getting better use of existing fertilizers. He or she has a better way of understanding where market prices are and how they should plan their inventory. He or she has a better way of getting credit. Those are all major innovations. They do not in any way tax the planet. If anything, they help the planet. I can give you example after example where there are innovations that are allowing us to do better things in a smarter way, in a smarter way for the planet. And yet we don't get to critical mass. Why don't we get to critical mass? Because we have the legacy of the old system that is still dominant. The old system where the institutions haven't been reformed enough, where international agreement on the environment, on climate, on other things haven't advanced enough. And that's why it's easy to make one case or the other. The important thing is to realize that both things are out there, and we need to tip the equation in favor of good outcomes.
Get busy or you're going to get a whole lot of trouble. Here's a comment from an Omaha guy, and he's listening to you say that Congress needs to get more engaged and take its economic responsibilities seriously, economic governance responsibilities. This speaks to the political climate, at least half of it, part of it. He says, how do you increase personal freedom and prosperity while avoiding a centralized economy? He hears you talking economic governance responsibility, and he fears centralized economy. What do you say?
I say that is what tends to happen in a polarized system is we go immediately to corner solutions. We take to the extremes. There's a teaser right now on NPR which speaks to an upcoming show that discusses why this Congress is the least productive in history, in history, and you can actually count that. A lot of the things I mentioned are not about making the state dominant. They're about empowering and enabling the private sector. Getting tax reform correct is about empowering and enabling the private sector. Having proper infrastructure is about enabling and empowering the private sector. It's not about the big state. It's about creating the conditions for better outcomes. I go back to the conductor. No one looks at the conductor and say, you are imposing yourself on all the great talent that you have in your orchestra. They look at the conductor and say, you are enabling the great talent that you have in the orchestra to do better.
Geopolitics. You more concerned maybe than the markets generally about Ukraine, though just recently the stock market's down and people are looking at what's going on in Iraq and Ukraine and beyond. How do those ever really impact the economic fork in the road question that you've put on the table? We've gone on as though they don't, as though we can sort of accommodate lots of chaos at the edges, but it's not so just at the edges anymore. How might one of these or the aggregate of these geopolitical crises that we're seeing turn into economic problems?
Look at the market reaction. Basically, markets have dismissed geopolitical risk. And let's focus on one area in particular, Ukraine. And the markets have dismissed it for two reasons. One is they believe that the central bank and the Fed, they're the market's best friend, and they will bail markets out over and over again. Why? Because they've been conditioned to believe that. But second, they look at what the rational outcome is. And the rational outcome is that neither Russia nor Europe continue on the current path of sanctions and counter-sanctions because it ends up in a lose-lose-lose situation. Lose for Ukraine, lose for Russia that gets tipped into a recession, and lose for Western Europe that risks energy disruptions because a lot of its energy comes from Russia via Ukraine. So the market says rational players would get off this course, therefore they will, and therefore we need not worry. The problem with that argument is that it assumes what economists call a perfect game. And a perfect game implies that you and I trust each other. You make commitments to me, I make commitments to you, and we can verify these outcomes. That's not the case right now in Ukraine. And therefore, what seems irrational because it's a lose, lose, lose is in fact rational if you don't have proper trust in the system. And what I worry about, Tom, is that we're going to take step by step greater action through sanctions and counter-sanction that may tip Europe into recession. And if Europe goes into recession, then the outlook for the global economy becomes significantly worse. That's why geopolitics count. That's why we need to pursue it and understand it. And we need to understand that what seems rational at a macro level may not be rational at the micro level.
Nancy in London, Kentucky. Nancy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to say, why don't we start with something concrete? For instance, raising the starvation level poverty, federal poverty limit, which will not only help the poor and the poor and working, but the middle class, most of the middle class that has fallen into those categories. Why not do that right now? And because...
You mean so that we get more federal and state government help for people? Is that what you mean, Nancy?
Yes.
I mean, how far do you... That would be great for people who profit immediately, but how far can we go in that down that path? Don't we need an economy that produces value?
Well, I think this would produce value. Well, it would produce spending anyway. Spending for food. I live in a state now where they have said that more than one out of four children live in poverty in this state. It's fine to talk about the market and this and that, but there are people starving in this country.
Nancy, I appreciate your call. Muhammad, Nancy says, hey, send some help right now. Let's get realistic and concrete.
So the point that Nancy raises is being hotly debated in the minimum wage. The classic argument against raising the minimum wage is that companies would hire fewer people, and therefore those who need jobs the most would be worse off, because even though wage levels have gone up, employment opportunities has come down.
Do you buy that?
I don't. I think that there's been a lot of research recently and a lot of evolutionary thinking that says that there's two sides to the minimum wage. There's the supply side, but also there's the demand side. And what we're seeing is people are starting to recognize that the benefits of raising the minimum wage, which is higher consumption for the most for a very challenged segment of the population, the benefits exceed the cost. And there's been a number of studies, and ironically, certain companies have voluntarily done that because they realize it's in their self-interest. So I go back, there's some evolution in the thinking, because a hollowed-out middle class and a very polarized society is in nobody's interest. There was some evolution in the thinking, but we're not quite there. But where Nancy is correct is you see it played out in the very hot, heated debates on the minimum wage. And certain states have gone forward raising the minimum wage, but it hasn't happened in a majority of states yet.
You said early on in our conversation that you were worried about the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and so on, developing alternative pipes. That is, sort of stepping out of the world that has been dominated by the United States and Europe and building their own economic infrastructure. What's the problem with that? If they've got the growth to support it, why is that necessarily a bad thing?
First, Tom, I sympathize with their frustration. Look at the IMF. Look at the voting power in the IMF. How do you explain rationally that China's voting power is equivalent to Belgium's? It's impossible to explain. Now, the reason why is because these institutions were created by the West 70 years ago, and their governance and their representation and their voice hasn't evolved consistent with what's happening out there. And Europe in particular is very hesitant to give up historical entitlements that make no sense. So countries like China are deciding, you know what, if the system isn't going to recognize that the world has changed, we will create alternative institutions. And now they have both the will and the ability to do so. The problem for the world is that the set of alternative institutions fragments what Tom Friedman correctly calls a hyper-connected world. So if you start fragmenting the institutional structure that supports a hyper-connected world, you get less efficient outcomes. The answer is not to tell China you're being irrational. The answer is to reform a system. And I don't know of anybody who has looked at this and hasn't come to the conclusion that it's time to reform the multilateral system to reflect the economy of today and tomorrow and not one of 70 years ago.
We've just got half a minute. If we're headed toward a fork in the road or a junction, up or down moment here, things can't go on as they have. You say the chances are 50-50, we're going up or down. What's the next thing you're looking at that will tell you whether we're headed up or headed down?
In the immediate, it is the geopolitical tension and whether in Ukraine, in Iraq, in Gaza, there's an ability to de-escalate the geopolitical tensions. That is critical. That is a day one issue, that if the escalation continues, then you change your probabilities and you shorten the road to the fork.
As we talk today, I can't say that the escalation looks headed down.
Yeah, but this is a very fluid situation. You know, it's a matter of decision making by individuals, particularly in Ukraine.
Mohammed Alarian, we've got our fingers crossed. You remind us we have to do more than that. Let's hope we do. We appreciate your spending some time with us today. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you.
Mohammed Alarian, former CEO at PIMCO, chair of President Obama's Global Development Council, big thinker. Thank you for joining us. Listeners all over the country and Detroit again, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.